This is the American Ag Network Week in Review for the week of October 13th. I'm Sabrina Hill. In a few moments, I talk with an expert on estate planning on what you need to know to protect your family. But first, Rusty Halverson has an update on the trade pact with Canada and Mexico from a dairy perspective.
U.S. dairy farmers got what they asked for in a new version of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The deal should remove uncertainty that's hurt the U.S. dairy industry since the White House began fighting with major trading partners. That, according to Tom Vilsack, former Ag Secretary during the Obama administration and current CEO of the U.S. Dairy Export Council.
First and foremost, we now know that we're going to have a trilateral agreement, assuming Congress ratifies this. This should free up time for USDR to focus on resolving issues with China and potentially entering into bilateral discussions with a number of other countries for free trade agreements. Preserves our number one market for dairy products in Mexico. Now, it doesn't yet remove the U.S. steel and aluminum tariffs and the retaliatory tariffs that Mexico assessed, and so hopefully the administration will get to work in getting that issue resolved so we can clear up this market situation down in Mexico. A little more market access to Canada for dairy, probably not as much as we'd like, but more than we had, which is a positive. And then, of course, the elimination of Class 7 and Class 6 pricing, replacing it with a new system. We'll see how that's implemented, but certainly a big step forward.
But at the end of the day, Vilsack says we'll have to see how it's all implemented.
It's spread out over a period of time and spread out over a number of products. And we're going to have to see whether or not the market truly is more open than it has been. We know that Canadians from time to time promise an open market and then figure out ways to make it more difficult. So the implementation of this is going to be really important. And the same thing is true with Class 7. The elimination of Class 7 replaces it with a system in which the Canadians can apply an applicable Canadian allowance. It's sort of like our make allowance. We want to make sure that that's a set number and it isn't something that gets manipulated from time to time to provide benefits to the Canadian producers.
U.S. Dairy Export Council CEO Tom Vilsack. I'm Rusty Halverson.
Have you thought about what happens to the farm if you're no longer around? It's a complicated issue with many facets, not one that most people like to talk about. We want to help you get some information on the matter. For this segment, we're talking with Dave Dvorak, who is the owner of Dvorak Law Group, based out of Omaha, Nebraska. All right, we want to talk about estate planning today, and I know that it's very important, especially when we're talking about family farms. But can you tell me why thinking about an estate plan should be important for our farmers?
Yeah, that's a great question, Sabrina. And I don't think it's just specific to farmers but or ranchers, but it's certainly probably more raw and real to farmers and ranchers, given their passion for what they do. But if you don't have an estate plan, very simply stated, the state has one for you. And so leaving it to lawmakers to dictate where your farm or your ranch will go, if that isn't unnerving, I don't know what would be. But the long and short of it is you need to be the one in control of the disposition of your assets when you die, because the state, recognizing that not everybody does that, has a series of statutes in place that will dictate where your assets go, which may be very inconsistent with where you wanted them to go.
So for people like me who are not attorneys, it sounds a little overwhelming to create an estate plan. What actually goes into this?
Well, and I think that's, you know, probably the biggest impediment to people getting it done, the fact that they have to go into an attorney's office and sort of bare their soul. But it's really, if you go to people that specialize in estate planning, and that's what I would recommend, you know, off the top, they're very efficient and very adept at getting to asking the right questions and culling the right information. But what goes into a estate plan from an estate planner's perspective is, number one, listening, getting the facts of the family and understanding the objectives. So first, the planner has to be a very good listener and has to know how to ask the right questions. Once we have the facts, there's kind of an educational component that plays into this. I mean, you have to know some basic rules. Tax rules, oftentimes, in the case of farming and ranching, are prevalent. You have to know, practically speaking, what happens when somebody dies, and really, what do we want to avoid? And oftentimes, that's this thing called probate. And then we will have a discussion typically about what's the vehicle that we utilize in the modern era to deliver an estate plan. In the old days, we used to use a good old-fashioned will. And now in the more modern era, we use typically this thing called a revocable living trust. And we would educate our clients on kind of those rules, taxes, probate avoidance, the vehicle that we utilize, but most importantly, getting the facts and the objectives. And then we kind of marry, you know, the rules of the game, if you will, with the facts and the objectives. And based on that, we make a recommendation as to what we think makes the most sense.
With all of the things that you mentioned, with the different aspects that are involved in estate planning, who all should be brought into this conversation? Do you want your insurance agents there? Do you talk to bankers?
Absolutely. That's a great question. And it's one of the most oftentimes overlooked aspects of this. I mean, you know, when you do an estate plan, yes, you know, in theory, people could, you know, find a form and hopefully if they follow the instructions and get it done. But that really leaves it undone. I mean, by having an estate planner, somebody that works in this field, they will absolutely assemble a team typically around you so that when you or your loved ones die or when both of you, husband and wife, die, there's a team set up. And typically that would consist of an attorney, estate planning attorney specifically, an accountant, oftentimes a banker or a trust company, an insurance professional, life insurance professional, and very often a money manager, a financial person. Any one of those individuals may have the relationship with the client. You know, in the old days, it used to be that the attorney had to kind of quarterback everything. Not so much. I mean, the key is getting those people on the same team and getting them to collaborate, whether it's the attorney that's got the main relationship or the accountant or the investment professional. You want all those people speaking together because it's very integrated. If you just go and try and do all that on your own, oftentimes you create more difficulty than you do solution. So,
and again, you know, it's one of those topics that a lot of times people don't want to think about. We don't want to think about having to plan for when we're no longer here, but especially people with families and businesses and family businesses, it's important to have all of these ducks in a row, if you'll let me use the expression. What do you do if you have some children who are on and off of the farm?
Well, I'll tell you, that's more the rule than the exception. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, people get paralyzed, as you kind of just alluded to, not wanting to think about how to deal with, you know, that very common scenario where you've got active and inactive family members in the farm. And quite frankly, there's a finite number of ways to deal with that. You know, but all of that goes to kind of you know, the older generation's objectives, and you know, typically those can people can be categorized, you know, from a philosophical standpoint in that scenario in one of three ways. You know, my family, for example, that has a ranch or a farm in west central Iowa, my grandparents, as it related to my mother, were very much of the view that fair was equal. My mom was a nurse and was not active in the farm, and her brother was active his entire life. And, you know, so my grandparents' view was that fair is equal. Notwithstanding that one was active, one was inactive. The flip side of that, I've had many clients, and again, there's no right or wrong answer here, take the approach that farming families come first, right? Meaning we're going to do everything we can to put farming families, that is the active children, in the position to keep farming, and generationally, you know, their families to keep farming, because that's what they do. And then you kind of have a hybrid of those two. You know, you've got some families that you know, view this as really an economic equation. We want to treat our kids, you know, generally equally economically, but we want to make darn sure that the farming families, the people that are active, can control the farming operation and manage it the way that they know how without interference from the inactive children. And oftentimes, as part of that strategy, which quite frankly I favor, because you allow, you know, for both actives and inactives to participate, but you create exit strategies. If the farming family wants to take out inactive numbers. You put in strategies that allow that at predetermined pricing methodologies and payment methodologies. Likewise, if the inactive family member wants to get out, meaning they don't want to be an owner in a farming operation that they have no control over, you give them the ability to get out. And so it's about creating exit strategies and creating fair pricing and payment terms for the farming family. So generally speaking, as overwhelming as some people think that it is, it's really pretty straightforward. I mean, and it ties to what the family's philosophy is. And generally, we can put people in one of those three categories: farming families first, fair is equal, or sort of that hybrid category. And then we can create solutions based on those objectives.
So just like every family is unique, every family can create the unique plan that's going to work for them.
Absolutely. No two are necessarily alike. They may share some commonalities, but again, that goes back to the first comment that I made. My role as an estate planner is to listen and understand what a family is saying and what their objectives are. And from that, we can craft a plan that stands the best chance of success once the older generation is gone and no longer in charge.
I'm going to bring up another topic nobody wants to talk about, but let's talk about taxes. How do taxes play into estate planning?
Well, right now we're in really good shape. Effective January 1, the government and all its benevolence, the federal government, essentially allows the husband and wife to pass up to $22.4 million of assets to the next generation without any federal estate tax consequence, or the death tax, as people commonly know it. The lion's share of farmers, not all of them, that number gets it done, right? But obviously, that's not always the case. And so to the extent that taxes that land and equipment and et cetera are over and above that, there are definitely some specific strategies that an estate planner that does this on a full-time basis knows how to utilize to minimize or ultimately mitigate potential taxes. I think the biggest thing to point out is that even though the law right now is drafted creates a $22.4 million free bite to farming families, the way the law is drafted is that is slated to come back to half of that, approximately, about $11 million in 2026, absent Congress and the then sitting president passing legislation to continue at the $22.4 million level. So planning needs to take place with the assumption that the amount that a farming family can pass is $11 million, because I think in all likelihood, given the deficits in our spending, they're going to look to generate additional tax revenue. And a real easy way to do that is on the federal estate tax side, because most people view it as a rich person's tax. For farmers, it's not that. It's that, they're often asset rich and cash poor, as they say. And if they get trapped, they end up having to sell land in order to pay the tax. And that's due within 9 months of the date of death of the survivor.
What is the biggest mistake you would say that people make when they're doing estate planning?
I think you touched on it, Sabrina. 100%, it's sort of paralysis by analysis or fear of doing this and getting it done. I mean, some people have this almost irrational thought that if I do my estate plan, I'm going to die. Right? My mentor back in the day, used to reiterate the old phrase, a job once begun is half done. Just get in, talk to somebody. I think it's cathartic for people. When they come in and we're sitting in a room, it's almost like a counseling session. They're explaining, their life, their philosophies. They're talking about their kids. I think if they do that, the technical stuff of it is easy. I mean, it just really is. But you got to get it going. Doing nothing is where all the problems ensue. And quite frankly, it costs exponentially more to unravel those things.
Again, Dave Dvorak with the Dvorak Law Group out of Hastings, Nebraska. This has been the American Ag Network Week in Review. I'm Sabrina Hill. For Rusty Halverson and myself, thanks for listening. Join us again next week.